With all that's been going on in Iraq lately, it's been harder to remember that there is still an American military presence in Afghanistan and a change in leaders taking place there, albeit through a disputed election. Today's guest is well acquainted with Afghanistan through many years of reporting there. Edward Girardet will speak tonight at 6:30 at the main conference room at the Medford Library. Edward Girardet has reported for the Christian Science Monitor, U.S. News and World Report, the McNeil Lehrer News Hour, and other media. His 2011 book about life and death and war in Afghanistan is called Killing the Cranes. And he's also walked in here with a brand new copy of The Essential Field Guide to Afghanistan, 4th edition, just out this year, which he helped edit. Edward Girardet, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Pleasure to be here, Jeff.
How does a guy born in White Plains, New York, get such an international education and exposure?
Well, my parents were sort of Swiss-British background, and they emigrated to the States. And I lived in different countries, Bahamas, Canada, Germany, so on, and numerous schools. And so I'm a mongrel, basically.
Where are you a citizen?
I'm U.S. and Swiss. I have two nationalities. And we now live in Geneva, actually on the French side in a small French village. And Geneva's just a great base to be operating out of. You know, you can cover Europe. You can travel to London for the day.
You're close to so much, and there are U.N. bases and other international
exactly.
entities
in fact,
there.
My wife works for the U.N. She deals with humanitarian response.
Was journalism your original goal, or did you just want to see the world? Or, I mean, what? How did journalism become your vocation?
Well, I wanted to be Hemingway.
Aha. So, you look a little like him, too. I've been told that.
The thing is, from the very beginning, in fact, you know, I was always editing school newspapers and so on and so forth. And when I finished, I went to university in England, and when I finished, in fact, the last day of exams, I didn't even stay for graduation. I drove straight to Paris, realized I couldn't survive as a writer, and did odd jobs teaching English, and then fell into journalism with a news agency. And from then onwards, I began covering France and then started covering international affairs as well.
Was there a particular place that you focused on before Afghanistan?
Well, before it was France, and I was doing very well. But the trouble in those days, Paris during the late 70s, 80s, Paris was the place to be as a foreign correspondent. If you were a photographer, all the major photo agencies were based there. The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Daily Mail, and so on, all had correspondents. And I kept meeting these journalists who'd come back from Salvador, from the Congo, and I just thought, what am I doing in Paris? So I really wanted to find my own Vietnam. I mean, I hate to say this. I wanted to find a war to cover. And a friend of mine from Time magazine said, well, you know, there's this little war that's beginning to erupt in Afghanistan. And this is just before the Soviets invaded.
And so what was going on at the time when you got to Afghanistan?
Well, I decided to head out there for what was then the Herald Tribune and various radio programs, CBC. The Soviets had not yet invaded, but there was a civil war. In fact, the war broke out in July 1978. You know, we keep talking about a 12-year, 13-year war. In fact, it's a 35-plus-year war. That's when war broke out between what were then the communists and these very conservative Afghans, who didn't like what was happening. There was very fast reform. So I went out to Kabul, and I took the bus from Peshawar in Pakistan. I mean, I was really nervous because I knew very little about Afghanistan. I had passed through as a student hitchhiking to India, which one did in those days.
Really? Seems like a long time ago, doesn't it?
It was a hell of a long time ago. But the thing was, I was always fascinated by Afghanistan. So I took the bus with a bunch of Sri Lankan migrants making their way to England, and I went to Kabul, convinced we were going to get attacked. Nothing happened, of course. And I got all this information. Of course, as always happens with a journalist, if you've been in a place for more than 4 days, you become an expert. And of course, as a journalist, you also realize that after 4 days, you know nothing. So I then got picked up by the Christian Science Monitor when the Soviets invaded.
So you were actually there when the invasion happened?
No, I was there before. Went back, did all my stories. The Monitor saw my Herald Tribune story and said, do you want to report for us as a Paris correspondent? And I began getting phone calls from Afghans who had met in Kabul weeks earlier saying, something is happening. The Russians are doing something. You should come back. And I approached my editor at the Christian Science Monitor, and I said, look, I should get back. And he said, look, Ed, we don't even know who you are. You know, we've never seen you, your experience. And so they wouldn't do that. And then, of course, when the invasion happened, I was out there 2 or 3 days later.
That's almost two generations ago. But, I mean, when you look at the key factions now, are they terribly different from the key factions that existed prior to the Soviet invasion?
No, not really. What happened was, during the Soviet occupation, you had 7 major factions, including fundamentalist extremists, one of them called Gulbuddin Hekmatyar of Hezbi Islami, which is a very fundamentalist Islamic group, who were massively supported by the Pakistanis and by the U.S. Ironically, Hekmatyar is still in action, and he's one of the leading pro-Talib groups in Afghanistan, responsible for a lot of the bombings. So, in fact, he was one of the monsters we helped create, because in those days, the thinking was very short-sighted. It was like, we have to get the Soviets out, and these guys are the most effective. But of course, these were the Pakistanis telling the Americans what to do. We went with that, and I think a lot of the really, really good commanders were not being supported for a long time. And I think, you know, we're paying for this now.
We were talking to, and will be talking more to, Edward Girard Day, the journalist who has been to Afghanistan many times. We will talk more with him and take your phone calls and emails as well about Afghanistan then, about Afghanistan now, and what has changed over the years. In a lot of ways, things have stayed the same in a bunch of different stripes. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from our break. Edward Girard Day and you back here in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the journalist Edward Girard Day. He is Swiss and American and has been reporting for a long time in many parts of the world, including a lot of time in Afghanistan, including his first stint there before the Soviet invasion in 1979. Been back a bunch of times since, written a book about it, also part of the Essential Field Guide to Afghanistan, which he helped edit. Now in its fourth edition, out since January of this year. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Now that I mentioned it twice, what is the Essential Field Guide to Afghanistan about? Who's it for?
Well, in the late 1990s, when the Taliban were in charge, there was no or very, very little international interest. And the UN came to us, a group of journalists, and said, what can we do? So we did a brainstorming and came up with various projects. One of them was a guide that could be used by aid workers, by journalists, by diplomats. And so this first edition came out. It was funded by the Dutch government. And then, of course, you know, with the after 9/11 and the U.S. intervention and so on, we did further editions. And it's really everything you want to know. It's health, agriculture, key players, who is who, how do you operate. We also have a thing which we got a small grant from the Fetzer Institute, and they said we want some projects which could be emulated elsewhere, which really work. So we did that. One of them, for example, is very positive but also a shocking story is a group about Skatistan, these two young Australians who came in. And they basically came with skateboards. And these street kids said, what are these? And they began teaching them how to use a skateboard. And they created an NGO to promote skateboarding, but also having a school, job education, so on and so forth. And they have now 300 kids. So this is one of these little – we call them Inspire boxes, mm-hmm. which we have in the field guide. Sadly, 6 of the kids were killed not too long ago when there was a bomb outside the – NATO headquarters in Kabul. I mean, very, very tragic. But the idea is it's a guide. You're not going to read in one go, but you'll pick it up. And if you're interested in environment, you can read the environment chapters. You can – I mean, it's really good background. The electronic edition has about 200 more pages. And so you can just go to Essential Field Guide or efgafghan.com and see that we run articles and so on and so forth. It's basically a background document. Of course, the military began using it. a lot because it gave the sort of background they needed, but they just would take whole sections for free, which we didn't really care about. But I'd much rather that the soldiers understand what's going on and also understand culture. And that's what there's a lot about that in the book.
So many of us just know Afghanistan as a battleground, as a place
right.
where other countries and empires work out their stuff via the local people. There's got to be more to it than that you have had that has brought you back there several times over the years.
Well, I mean, basically, when I first went there, I was fascinated. I'd read, you know, various history books, Kipling, so on and so forth. The history is fascinating. But when I began traveling in Afghanistan, and ironically, during the Soviet occupation, I did a lot of trips by foot, 700-800 miles by foot, through the Hindu Kush, through deserts. And in many ways, we, the journalists or the aid workers, because we often traveled with the French doctors, because that was one way of seeing what was happening, because we couldn't talk to women, but they could, because there were female doctors. And we would spend the nights in villages, and we really got to know Afghans. And I'd go in for 5-6 weeks at a time, and I couldn't report while being inside, because, of course, we had no satellite phones at the time. So I took a lot of notes, and when I came out, I would write a series for the Monitor and for other people, or did McNeil era specials. But in a sense, we were privileged to have access to this extraordinary country with very extraordinary people, with one foot in the 19th century and the other foot in the 20th century, because we had horses, we walked, and then you had, you know, attacks by MiGs and helicopter gunships. But you would stay with Afghans, you got to talk to them, and sometimes it was exhausting because you would arrive in a village, you would ask your questions, all the elders would put you down, give you tea, and you drank a lot of tea, I can tell you that. And then they'd say, okay, you've asked your questions, now we have our questions. And they all listened to the BBC World Service in Pashto or in Dari or Voice of America, and also Kabul Radio, Iranian radio and Radio Moscow. So they were pretty well informed. But they would ask, you know, at the time about the Falklands War.
Why really? Oh, war? Sure, in 1982.
Yeah. Or about U.S. presidential candidates. Who, mm-hmm. you know, who is this one and that one? And they were really stunningly well informed. So you'd have this, and, you know, I'd always be traveling with two or three other journalists and the doctors. We had horses, you know, with our equipment and food. But we'd always have a designated speaker because we were also exhausted. So one of us would have to talk for the whole evening with these Afghans while the other ones pretended to listen but were actually trying to sleep.
Oh, right.
So, but it got you into contact with this country. And I think that's the problem today and the past 10, 12 years is that whether you're an aid worker or a journalist or a soldier, you really haven't got that same access because today – and the past 10 years, it's actually been more dangerous to cover Afghanistan than it was then, even during the Soviet War, which is a brutal war. You know, over 1.5 million Afghans died as a result of that war. But it was, you had the contact. And today, sadly, you haven't got the contact because if you're an aid worker or you're a soldier, you're in a compound, you're locked away. And even the journalists, you know, you're risking your life in a way which you were not doing during the 1980s and even the 90s.
Is the difference who is fighting, how many people are fighting, the tactics?
The tactics have changed to a degree. The Mujahideen, the Afghan guerrillas during the Soviet period, are really not much different from the Taliban today. They fight in very much the same way. The thing that changed, though, and this is the huge change, are the IEDs, the bombs. These are totally and utterly indiscriminate. And before, the Mujahideen would lay mines, but these would be laid against tanks on roads, and these would be these huge Chinese mines, and usually they didn't work. The groups today are much more sophisticated, and they don't care whether they kill civilians, and more than half the soldiers, whether U.S. or NATO, have been killed or injured by IEDs. So it's a different form of warfare. And also, you have different groups. We keep talking about the Taliban. You really can't use that term because there are so many different groups, as happened during the 1980s. You have others. You have groups which are like the Haqqani network, which is pretty ruthless. And I knew Haqqani, the father, who's still alive, but his son is running it. They were great commanders during the Soviet period and supported by the Americans. Now they've become incredibly ruthless. And also, a lot of the commanders are young. The older ones have been killed off by the drones. So, in fact, the very people we should be talking with we're killing, and the new ones who come up, they no longer have any link with Afghan culture. They're operating out of Pakistan, and they are much more hardline.
That brings me back to a question that seems rather obvious now, which is there an Afghanistan in the sense of any sort of cohesion as a country by that name, by that identity? And it sounds like it's very, very fragmented.
It's very fragmented, but at the same time, I mean, during the Soviet period, the Soviet war brought together the Afghans as Afghans. And for 10 years, the Afghans operated as Afghans. They'd say, Watandar, which means countrymen, a wonderful expression. And I would use it sometimes. I'd say, hey, Watandar. And they were like, break out laughing because, you know, why is this foreigner calling us countrymen? Right. But what it used to mean, it meant someone from your village. Then it became someone from your district or your region. And then it became someone from Afghanistan. That disappeared when the Soviets left. And then it became Tajiks and Pashtuns and so on and so forth. Nowadays, I think a lot of Afghans, when they talk to foreigners, they'll talk about being Afghan. But when they're amongst themselves, you have the divisions. And the problem now is that with the international intervention and what happened since 9/11 was that we made a lot of mistakes, the international community, and a lot of missed opportunities. And we missed the chance, I think, of helping the Afghans create a real Afghanistan, which was from the bottom up. We've been trying to create it from the top down. And Afghans don't trust anyone from Kabul, but they trust people from their own region, whether we like them or not. And a lot of the Taliban, they have popular support because they represent that region. But even amongst the Taliban, they will talk about foreign Taliban who they don't trust because they come from different areas. So it's very difficult to make sense out of a lot of this. There's nothing black and white. In fact, there's never, ever been anything black and white, you know.
Right. Many tribes, many divisions. We're talking about Afghanistan with Edward Girard Day, the well-traveled journalist, has been to Afghanistan many times. He'll be speaking tonight at 6:30 at the main conference room at the Medford Library. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange now at 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Edward Girard Day.
Good morning. I have one of their hats. And I have two questions. One is fairly, well, I guess they're both overarching. One, in the time since we have invaded Afghanistan, is the life of the average Afghan net better or net worse? Are they better off? Are they worse off? That's the first question. I'll take my answers off the air. The second question has to do with the fact that what you're dealing with is and you've struck on this several times, you're dealing with an ethnic and political mosaic rather than an organized society. And my question is, a larger, more overarching one, dealing with places like Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, is there any way that you can see that Western-style systems of organization can be successfully, and should they be, applied as an overlay to those organizations? Is there any way to do it? I really question it. I'll take my answers off the air.
All right, Paul. Thanks. Good to hear from you.
Paul, first of all, very good questions. And I first want to comment on the hat known as a cola. There's a brilliant cartoon by Jeff Danziger when the Soviets left, showing one Afghan with a turban and the other Afghan with a woolen hat, which was basically from the north. And one of them says, "Muhammad, now that the Soviets have gone, I've always wanted to tell you, I hate your hat." And what the cartoon, this summed it all up for me. A brilliant cartoon, because in fact it showed immediately the divisions, because the northerners tended to wear, Massoud's people and so on, had the woolen hat. But the question about are they better off, I mean, that's an excellent question. So much money has been spent on Afghanistan, over $61 billion by the U.S. alone, just for recovery, which is more than the Marshall Plan at the same rate. The second is almost $300 billion worth of military intervention. There's been a lot of corruption. We talk about corruption with Afghans, but there's also been a lot of corruption with international, with Western corporations. I mean, the amount of money that has been wasted in Afghanistan and Iraq is monumental. And I think one of the things was we went in there, and I say we, the international community, not just the Americans. There were the bond talks in December 2001 saying this is how it's going to be in Afghanistan. But there were quite a few expats or foreigners, American diplomats, aid workers, journalists who really understood Afghanistan. And I was part of this group with the Council on Foreign Relations. And the advice we were giving based on our experience in 2001, 2002 was whatever you do in Afghanistan, go slow. Don't throw money at it. Take a very long-term perspective, 20, 30 years if necessary. And don't expect instant change. It's just not going to happen. You have to move very slowly. And, of course, no one, particularly in democracies with vote, you know, elections coming up, is going to do that. So a lot of money was put on the ground. A lot of agencies got involved, a lot of corporations, security. I think a lot of the security companies, you know, upped the ante by saying it's becoming dangerous, you need us. The first 2 years, we had all these opportunities, and many of them were missed. One of them being that we should have focus more on the countryside where over 70% of the Afghans live. But now it's probably just slightly under. And
so we tend to focus on fixing the capital and making sure
exactly
that's orderly.
Fixing and making it seem Western. And of course, the Afghans love this, the ones in the capital, you know, air conditioning, electricity, tarred roads. But in fact, the real change should have come in the rural areas. Now, a lot has happened. I mean, health care is better. Except when you look at the figures, 70% of the healthcare is private. So Afghans do have access to doctors, but they're not going to send their wife, who's pregnant, for a checkup. They can't afford it. And so what often happens is the woman goes too late. You have over 7 million kids now at school, which is incredible. But still, another half are not at school. But so you do have positive changes. But when you look at the way the money was spent, I think we could have done far more and far better and spent far less. And also, I think to have a military intervention did not help. I think the big confusion during the late 2001 was that we confused the Taliban with al-Qaeda. Now, the Taliban were involved in a civil war with the United Front or Northern Alliance. The term, by the way, Northern Alliance, was given by Pakistan's ISI, the military intelligence, to try and create division. And the journalists, we all picked up the expression, but the real expression is United Front. There was a civil war going on, and the Taliban took support from, as every Afghan group has always done, from whoever gave money. And the Al-Qaeda was one of many, you know, outside supporting groups. And the Taliban did not have control over Al-Qaeda. Taliban means scholars. And they're certainly not scholars. You know, there are very, very few who are actually educated. But they, you know, I think the Al-Qaeda was, and other Arab groups, and were doing what they wanted anyway. So, but we confused all this because of the emotion behind 9/11 and began a war which is unnecessary. And I remember, you know, quite a few journalists who had been there before saying, you know, the bombing, it may satisfy your emotions, but it's you'll be creating new Al-Qaedas, new bin Ladens. And I think that that was one of the problems. So, you know, we've come in with a lot of institutions which are Western democracy. We can talk about that afterwards. Being one of them, democracy does work to a point, but it's got to work in a very Afghan way. And if you're looking at what does work politically in Afghanistan, maybe it should have been a Swiss-style solution. I say Swiss, slightly tongue-in-cheek, but in the sense that the Swiss cantons have a lot of autonomy. And they basically leave foreign affairs and finance to be run by Bern, by the Swiss capital. But each canton does what it wants. And that's perhaps what should have happened with Afghanistan, because the local and regional Afghans trust their own people. They don't trust Kabul. And we took that away from them. And I think now there's a move back to this, or what should have happened 12, 13 years ago. So that may be one of the institutions you're looking at that could work. And I think now with the elections, we're facing a whole new slew of problems, which we can talk about.
It seems like that quite often when foreign entities, foreign governments come in and try to do things in Afghanistan, they don't even have as good a set of facts and a feel for the landscape as do the journalists who've covered it.
Yeah. I mean, I think the aid workers, there are a number of groups like the Médecins Sans Frontières, there's the Swedish Committee for Afghanistan. They have always worked in rural areas, and they're some of my best sources. I would go somewhere, and I would talk with them and get really good on-the-ground information.
All right, much more to talk about Afghanistan with Edward Girard Day, longtime journalist appearing at the Medford Library tonight at 6:30. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from the break. Back with Edward Girard Day and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about Afghanistan with the journalist Edward Girard Day. He is both an American and a Swiss citizen, dual citizenship, and has been to Afghanistan many times, has gotten to know many, many people there, came face-to-face with Osama bin Laden, interviewed Ahmed Shah Massoud as well. We'll talk about both of those meetings coming up. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Afghanistan and how it can and does or does not work. 800-838-3760 around the region. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. You had mentioned that, and it was in the context of the post-September 11th American invasion of Afghanistan, but let's go back to when the Soviets left, and the fact is that we were supporting the Mujahideen against them, against the Soviets. Often has been said, if we just spent a few more dollars, left a few more schools open, done whatever, we would have ended up with a very different Afghanistan than the one that was used as a launch pad against us 10 years later.
Yeah, I think what happened was after the Soviets left, we basically dropped Afghanistan, as did the European Union. It wasn't just the U.S. You know, everything was finished and everything changed. And what this led to was a new civil war, which people warned about. Pakistan was, of course, doing its own thing, which was pushing Gulbuddin Hekmatyar to try and win, and that failed. I think everyone assumes that by going in, they can control events. And, you know, even Afghans have realized they can't control events in Afghanistan. So after the civil war, then the Taliban came, and this led to al-Qaeda, 9/11, so on and so forth. So I think the lesson there is that you can't just play around with a country for 10 years and then sort of say, well, you know, we're out, that's finished. You had they continued perhaps with at least with recovery support, with education. And, you know, the irony is, of course, is that the refugee experience, which was, you know, 3 million Afghans in Pakistan, 2 million in Iran, kids actually learned about school. These were highly conservative Afghans who didn't want their girls going to school, but they were forced to by the Pakistanis. When they came back to Afghanistan, these highly conservative Pashtuns sent their girls to school. Okay, only primary school, not secondary. But it showed, you know, there are positive elements which we should have focused on, and that just did not happen. We just pulled out, and that was it, and then there was a vacuum.
It sounds like part of the problem is simply a cultural one. That, again, you had mentioned earlier that we need to be thinking in terms of 20- and 30-year horizons. You know, what's the joke in American politics now? You can't get anything done in an election year or the year before. Oh, wait, that makes sense every year. So yeah, we just think in terms of getting to the next election in American politics, don't think hardly ever about what are we going to be doing with the decisions we make today in 20 or 30 years. And that seems to be a large cultural barrier for us.
Absolutely. And the thing is that there are qualified people on the ground who know this. I mean, USAID used to have, and that's happening again, they used to have really good people on the ground. And these are people who would spend 20 years in a region. I mean, they might go from Afghanistan to Nepal and then to India and then back to Afghanistan. But these were people who, when they had R&R, they didn't go to fly to Dubai for the weekend. They would go up country to see the families of their employees. So they understood. I mean, there were a lot of really good people on the ground. And all that's been lost. Even today, people go to Kabul for 6 months. There, you know, whether you're at the U.S. mission and you're behind a compound, there are people who never even step out of the compound for 6 months. Fine, it's dangerous, but you can't operate in a country unless you're out there. And it may mean, you know, winding down some of your commitment, but then at least get out there and not lose touch with what's going on. And I think the, you know, there are people there today who realize education is crucial. But then jobs. I mean, what's happening now? The military is pulling out. Over 100,000 jobs have already been lost. Each Afghan probably supports another 20 Afghans. So that's a lot of people. That's, you know, 2 million people. So the end result will really be, how can you make Afghanistan economically viable? And Afghans are, you know, they're merchants. They're good farmers. There's a lot. But this is what we should have perhaps focused on. We did not. We focused on a military intervention.
Let us take a call. Here's Ariel in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Edward Girardet. Ariel, you there?
Yes, hi. I would like to ask Mr. Girardet, what American foreign policy changes would he like to see put in place? What should we do differently?
All right, thanks for that, Ariel.
Well, that's also a good question. I think now that the military are leaving, some will stay. Probably special forces. But I think U.S. policy has to continue and it has to be focused on recovery. It has to be 20 years, and whether that's going to happen or not is another question. But I think that really is the basis. The focus has to be on long-term development and investment. I mean, Afghanistan has extensive resources, copper, iron, gold, you know.
No oil, though, right?
There is oil. There's natural gas. They believe there's a lot of oil. I mean, they're digging for oil. Some has been discovered. Whether it's on a massive basis, we don't know yet. But certainly there's a lot of potential there. I mean, everyone likes to talk about potential. But it can't just be development. It's got to be investment as well. But no one's going to invest when there's a security issue. And it really has to come down to talks. And right now, Qatar is leading the talks. So that's where the basis is, and the Pakistanis. But the question is, do you really want the Pakistanis running the show again? I think that's highly questionable, and it's got to be an international approach. I think perhaps the UN has a role, the European Union has a role, but no one's really come to grips with that yet. So I think in the meantime, at least, you know, not just drop the country again, but focus on intelligent development and intelligent investment, because, you know, we keep talking about Afghanistan being the crossroads of Central Asia, and, you know, there are projects for building railroads linking Iran with India, with Pakistan, north-south as well. So there is this potential, but it's not going to happen if there's no peace.
Let's talk about the two major figures that you run across, of many, obviously, Osama bin Laden and Ahmad Shah Massoud. You had encounters with both of them.
Well,
once with bin Laden, though, right?
Yeah, well, actually, twice with bin Laden. But with Massoud, Massoud was one of the great commanders, a fascinating guy. I met him back in 1981 when a French journalist said to me, you know, there's this really interesting commander who's beginning to emerge and is known as the Lion of Panjshir, and you should go up and see him. So I trekked in with two other journalists and with some French doctors, and we met him, and we'd heard a lot about this guy, Ahmad Shah Massoud, who's a Tajik, and he was the one who was really beginning to become a thorn in the side of the Soviets. And when I first met him, you know, I'd heard so much about this extraordinary man, and he walks in, and all I could think of was, my God, he looks like Bob Dylan. And we got to know each other over the years, and I saw him many times, reported with him. He'd run many, many offensives against the Soviets. That they just could not contain him. And he had a very good reputation in Kabul. But he was never taken seriously by the Americans. And the Pakistanis couldn't stand him because he was a Tajik. Oh. And he was not a Pashto, and they wanted to push the fundamentalists. Massoud began getting U.S. support probably from 86, 87 onwards, but not before then. With bin Laden, it was the week before the Soviet pullout in February 1989, and I was going in to prepare a McNeil era segment. And I went in with Steve McCurry, who's a very well-known National Geographic photographer, did that very famous photograph of the girl with the green eyes, which everyone knows. And we went in, and there were these Arabs on the front line. There was still a lot of fighting going on between the Afghan forces, governed forces, and the Mujahideen. And this very tall Arab came up to me in English and said, "What are you doing here? This is not your jihad." And I thought, yeah, who is this guy telling me, you know, what to do? So I responded to my interpreter and said, "What's he saying?" Because it was a matter of face-saving now.
Oh.
And the interpreter could understand, but he's speaking English. Why are you? And I said, "Just tell this man that I'm a guest in this country just as he is, and that I will leave if my hosts want me to leave, just as I'm sure he will leave if they want him to leave." So we then – and then we began talking to each other, and we talked for about 45 minutes. And we talked about being Ahle Kitab, which means of being Jewish, Christian, or Muslim. It's of the book, the Old Testament. And but it was also a very childish discussion. Like,
I know, exactly.
That sort of thing. And the Afghans just thought this was hilarious. And all the Arabs, about six of them, you know, they were from Egypt, from Sudan, all standing behind him. But we had a good conversation, and I didn't know who he was. And I just thought he was one of these Wahhabi who were there, and a lot of money, you know, buying support from the Afghans. And as I left with Steve, he called out. He said, "If I see you again, I'll kill you." And the next week, I went back with the camera crew. And the Afghan commander said, "Look, we have to go down the front line again." And I said, "Well, you know, they're these crazy Arabs. I'm not sure I really want to do this." And they said, "No, this is Afghanistan. These Arabi don't tell us what to do." We went down, and we nearly got killed because, first of all, the Afghan governed forces were shelling us with mortars. And I kept thinking, you know, these guys are not worried about these mortars. I am. And they came up to me, I was screaming, this tall man, and said, "I told you not to come back here. You know, how dare you?" Guns were pulled, and I thought, we're going to get blown away. You know, and I thought, after 9 years of reporting this war, I'm not going to get killed by the Soviets. I'm going to get killed by these crazy people. And we finally managed to pull away when the Afghan commander stepped in between and said, "Stop, this is not good for Islam." And we drove down the road, and the commander then said, "I want to show you something." And he showed us a field, cornfield. And there were mummified hands and pieces of bodies sticking out of the ground. And he said, "These Arabi, they executed all these prisoners, but they slit them with the throats. They slit their throats." And he said, "You don't kill a man by slitting their throat. You shoot him." And I mean, which was, you know. But the fact was, the Afghans were insulted. And I heard later, they went back and arrested about six of these Arabi, and they executed them. Because of the insult. I could never verify this, but that's what I'd heard. And it was only years later that one of the Afghan commanders, I bumped into him in Kabul, said to me, "You remember the very tall Arab you saw?" I said, "Yeah." "You know who he was?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, Osama bin Laden." And then he thought, absolutely. And then I went to Steve McCurry, and I said, "You know, you've got to have some photographs of this guy." And he never found any because he was so busy photographing the front line.
Sure. I'm just struck by the fact that there are bombs bursting around you and this guy wants to kill you for showing up with a camera.
I know. Yeah. And I mean, that was it, because these mortars are moving nearer and nearer and nearer, and he didn't care.
Wow. And then you were very close in time and in proximity to Ahmed Shah Massoud when he was assassinated, which was quickly followed by the September 11th attacks.
Exactly. I mean, I was there for National Geographic, and I got up north to see Massoud, and I really wanted to sit down with him because he had come under a lot of criticism for being in charge of Kabul and for continuing to fight the Taliban, and a lot of people died. About 50,000 Afghans died in the battle for Kabul. So he was being criticized, you know, human rights abuses and so on, and I actually wanted to sit down with him as a human being and say, "Well, what is your assessment after all these years? You fought the Soviets, now you're fighting the Taliban," and he didn't turn up. So I was waiting on the border with Tajikistan. There were two Arab journalists in the room next to me, and they would come out every day with their film equipment, and we were waiting for Massoud, who never turned up. And the reason why it didn't turn up was because there was a lot of dust. They had these winds, and the helicopters couldn't come in, and no one wanted to say where he was. And after about a week of this, and I was trying to do small stories, you know, get away, but I didn't want to leave too long, I said, "Okay, I'll come back in 2 weeks' time. My wife's birthday is on September 13th. I've got to go back for that because I can face the Taliban, but I can't face her if I miss her birthday." And so I left, and the plan was to come back. By then, I'd received a Talib visa, and I was going to go to the Talib areas and then cross the lines back into Massoud's area. That was all the plan anyway. Mm-hmm. And as I left, I saw one of the Arabs, and I said, "Are you going to hang around?" And he said, "Absolutely. You know, we're going to wait for him." And I said, "Well, you know, it could take ages." And he said, "No, we're going to wait." And we spoke in French. And I drove away. And a couple of days later, I was leaving for London. It was September 10th, 6 o'clock in the morning. I was listening to BBC on my radio. And there was an announcement saying there had been an assassination attempt against Massoud by two Arabs posing as journalists. And I knew exactly who they were. And then, of course, 9/11 happened 2 days later, in fact, when I got back to Europe. But I think the two were linked. I think the agreement was with al-Qaeda and the Taliban is we'll get rid of Massoud, who by then had only 20% of Afghan territory. And once he's gone, the whole Northern Alliance will collapse. And I think that was all part of the whole 9/11
the whole story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there ever any doubt in your mind that Osama bin Laden was behind it all?
Well, I think that's never really been clear either. I think he certainly funded. He became a funder after and a fundraiser.
A venture capitalist.
Yeah, a venture capitalist. Because in the beginning, bin Laden was there as a humanitarian. He was providing humanitarian relief to Afghans and so on. Then he created this organization known as the Base, al-Qaeda, bringing in all these volunteers. And you would see them around Peshawar in Pakistan. In fact, his office was 300 yards from the American Club in Peshawar, where all the journalists, aid workers, mm-hmm. spies, everyone went to. And his office was down the road. And you would see these volunteers, these jihadists, who, I mean, Afghanistan was the only jihad going. I mean, I talk about this in Killing the Cranes, the book where I was trying to explain why we have this absurd situation.
Edward Gerard Day wrote Killing the Cranes. He's also one of the editors of The Essential Field Guide to Afghanistan, now in its fourth edition, A Long History in Afghanistan. He'll talk tonight at Medford Library at 6:30 in the main conference room. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks very much, Jeff.
It's a pleasure.